Can't get enough of America's undocumented anchorman? SteinOnline.com is your one-stop shop for all things Stein. Catch new episodes of The Mark Stein Show. Sit back and experience features like Stein's Song of the Week and Mark Stein's Tales for Our Time. Get the most of Stein Online by joining the Mark Stein Club, a global community of people just like you. The show never stops for members of the Mark Stein Club. Head on over to steinonline.com/club for details.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. May 14th, 2025. It is 3 p.m. in Washington, D.C., where a favorite Stein Show guest, the cardiologist Dr. Asi Malhotra, has been appointed chief medical advisor of MAHA, Make America Healthy Again. 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in London, where the police have abandoned their investigation into Rupert Lowe MP after Farage and co. reported him to the Met for allegedly threatening Zia Youssef's life. 9 p.m. in Paris, where Monsieur Macron is back from his cocaine bender on Kiev's cokey nose-blow choo-choo. 10 p.m. in Doha, where President Trump is schmoozing the Qataris following his first ever spin of a village people platter on stage in Riyadh. The assembled Saudi princes so enjoyed it, they're making gay disco compulsory in every madrasa. 10:30 p.m. in Tehran, for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. Midnight in Muzaffarabad in Kashmir, where the Indo-Pak ceasefire brokered by Trump appears to be holding. Midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 3 a.m. in Singapore and Hong Kong, sorry about that. 6 a.m. in Canberra, where the Liberal Party, Australia's alleged right-of-centre party, has its first female leader after this month's election fiasco and the ignominious departure of, what's name? 8 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. 300 years ago today, May the 14th, 1725, Ludovico Manin was born. He was the last Doge of Venice. That's a pre-Elon Musk Doge. The last Doge, born 300 years ago, governed the Venetian Republic from 1789 to May the 12th, 1797, when he was forced to abdicate by Napoleon Bonaparte. And thus, after 1100 years, the Venetian Republic came to an end. A republic, if you can keep it, said Benjamin Franklin. Well, the Venetians kept it longer than anyone else has managed to date. 1,100 years. If you recall, I first started mentioning the Venetian Republic when I was stricken by my heart attack in Trieste and holed up there for a while, because I'd sort of clear forgotten that Trieste was part of the Venetian Republic, because the name sounds like a city-state, but it stretched all the way up the western shore of the Adriatic to Trieste, and then all the way down the eastern shore to Albania, and at its height also included Crete and Cyprus. Is the American Republic going to make it 1,100 years? That would be, let's work this out, to the year 2876. To the year 2876. Well, it ain't going to get there if Chief Justice Roberts and Senator Tillis and the like have anything to say about it. The last Doge, of Venice, Ludovico Manin, born 300 years ago today. Okay, let us get to your questions, because I get snide emails about the history, like I used to get about the music. So I'll do the passive-aggressive thing and get rid of that. There's not going to be a lot to this show by the time it's been filleted of everything that makes it distinctive. Mark, says Robert Norris, I continue to be aghast by the cozying up to the new regime in Syria, in which we seem to trade one set of butchers for another. Is this the price everyone pays to placate Turkey and Recep Tayyip Erdogan? It seems to just store up more trouble for Israel, who should probably hang on to that extra territory they grabbed near Golan. Yeah, they should hang on to that. On the other hand, one is forced to deal with the facts of life, and this guy is running Syria. And so he has, as a practical matter, control of that state. Now, is Trump, in that sense, is not getting mixed up or on side with any faction in Syria in the way that, say, John McCain used to do. John McCain, you know, and Lindsey Graham flew off to Syria and were photographed with all these people who, you know, turn out to be hardcore jihadists, because the United States is a tourist in the heart of darkness. And it shouldn't be, and that's one more reason why it shouldn't be getting mixed up in wars in this region. I don't think it's anything to do with Erdogan. I mean, Erdogan now is he actually the longest-running head of government in the world? For one who's purportedly elected, has to be regularly elected, he's been there a long time, and he's been doing this straddle, basically as a sort of embryo caliphate, and at the same time a NATO member, so he has a foot in both camps, as it were. But I don't think that's the reason that Trump has put an end to the various sanctions imposed on Syria. I'm not really a big fan of sanctions because, as we've just seen with Russia for the last 3 years, they proved completely ineffectual with Russia. But I do think, you know, Trump's thing provoked, as I wrote this morning, I think, provoked this big thing from Mark Levin. I'm not so sure if you're a friend of Israel, by the way, whether it's worth having people like Mark Levin advance your interests in Washington. You can take that for what it's worth. He testified against me in court. He testified under oath that I was a putz. And he lost that case. So then he and his buddy sued me again, and they lost that case too. And so they've stopped suing me, it appears. One should never say these things definitively. But Trump got all... Levin was a never-Trumper in 2016 until, you know, 3 weeks before the election. I wasn't. Those guys were all hot for Ted Cruz, who seemed to me... I'm just talking about... I couldn't see how Ted Cruz added up the Electoral College math. And so I didn't think there was any point in nominating Ted Cruz because he would just be the latest Republican loser. But Levin stayed away from Trump until it hurt his bottom line. And then, whatever it was, 3 weeks before the election, he decided he was on board with Trump. And Trump's a susceptible fellow, and so he wasted a lot of his first term hanging out with people who did not really have Trumpism, so-called, at heart. But, you know, he was the president, and they did not feel it was... You know, there's never Trumpers, And then there's not quite sure Trumpers who've come around. And then there's people who are playing at being Trumpers. And I don't think the point about Trump is that he was a repudiation of early 21st century republicanism, which meant that which is the sort of George W. Bush, John McCain line, that America. I remember actually in the White House 20 years ago. Talking with George W. Bush about going into, he said something, and I said, "You mean you're going into Syria?" And he said, "Now you're talking, boy." And that would have been a complete disaster, because the Pentagon is responsible for 40% of the planet's military spending, and it's crap. As Pete Hegseth well knows, which is why he's getting rid of an awful lot of people. But because it's crap, because it cannot use 40% of the planet's military budget to advance a single strategic interest of the United States, it shouldn't be going to war with anybody. And if you're not going to war with anybody, so if you figure this guy in Syria, he's there until he gets overthrown, until they come for him, then what you do, once you've accepted that he's there, then all the rest is just posturing. And I'm not sure that's terribly helpful to anybody. And I don't see the point of it. Fred Jones says, "Mark, already this week we've been confronted with two cognitive dissonance experiences on the international stage. One, Starmer acknowledged the problem of unfettered illegal immigration into the UK. And two, Trump wholly embraced the proud heritage of the Arab Gulf states, which he credited for the unprecedented build-up of their impressive infrastructure and lavish gifts bestowed upon easily duped Western elites, like, say, a $400 million state-of-the-art jet to leapfrog Boeing's interminably late Air Force One replacements. I suppose the first could easily be characterized as cynical political posturing, but the fact that the Labour leader called out this problem in public seems significant given that party's reliance on the recent arrivals. And the second could be Trump embracing true global diversity as a means of kneecapping Western foreign affairs experts, taxpayer-funded NGO meddlers, and of course the Shiite Persians, but his sycophantic praise of the Sunni state leaders was laid on awfully thick. No mention of how their oil dollars have fueled the international terrorism indoctrination madrasas, corrupted our Western universities, and molded and manipulated Western leaders for two generations. And of course, no mention of the total lack of civil rights for their own subjects. Make sense of it all, Mark." Well, the Starmer thing is important, because basically he's blaming, as he can do very easily, the open borders on wankers like Boris Johnson. And that he can blame the open border. The so-called conservatives have been running the United Kingdom since the year 2010, and all they've done is made things worse, including letting in 1,000 Albanian sex traffickers every night. Now, Starmer has actually, they're all accusing him in Fleet Street of having gone full Enoch Powell with his famous Rivers of Blood speech. And in fact, if you want to make that comparison, you can. Said he says it's going to become an island of strangers. It's actually that already. Whether Starmer is actually serious about doing anything, and I don't believe he is, but the fact that he feels obliged to say this in public is a sign of where the conversation's going. So simply because Keir Starmer is now talking like Enoch Powell, the Overton window is on the move. People don't want this. People can see it. London is a crap hole these days. I can't believe, because, you know, I I sort of fly in once every year or two for about 30 years. But I hadn't lived there for a third of a century, basically, or whatever it was, until this GB News thing started, and I found myself flying into London far more often than I used to. It's awful. The Anglo-Celtic population of London is falling in some parts of, you know, everyone thinks it's all the sort of, because the TV, the pop culture hasn't caught up yet. So if you watch BBC soap operas like EastEnders, you would think there was still such a thing as a Cockney. He's not. He should be on the endangered species list. There are seven left in Greater London. The Anglo-Celtic population of the capital city, the English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, have fallen far lower than Enoch Powell would have predicted in that speech in 1968. So the fact that he feels he has to say this is hugely significant because FACOs like Johnson, because the Labour Party was genuinely always in favour of mass migration. The Conservatives were supposed not to be. They weren't in favour of it under Mrs. Thatcher, for example. But Boris basically lied his arse off as the treasonous little SH1T, as Jane Clark used to say of her late husband, the great philanderer Alan Clark. I'm quoting her every week now, but certainly Boris Johnson is a complete SH1T. It's meant to sound like a personalised licence plate. Now, on the so it's significant that Keir Starmer feels that it's in his interest to get to the right of the David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak Tory party. That's interesting. Now, when you talk about Trump wholly embracing the proud heritage of the Arab Gulf states, yeah, he did lay it on a bit thick. Whenever Trump does that, though, I just think of all those, you know, celebrity introductions you used to get on crappy television years ago. Bob Fosse satirizes it in All That Jazz, in that film, where whoever it is always being introduced, one of the greatest humanitarians I have ever known. You know, that's all he's doing there. Doesn't mean anything. What's important, and this is why it's driving Mark Levin nuts, is he's saying this is not the Bush era GOP. This is not the John McCain GOP. We are not launching wars and enriching the disgusting military industrial complex lobbyists by fighting a 20-year war and then losing it. Losing, as I always say, to goat herds with fertilizer and showing how butch we are by droning the seven most photogenic moppets in Kabul on the way out the door, which was barely covered in the US media, but I can tell you is a big story everywhere else. America is crap at war. It can't do it. It honestly, it just can't do it. And you know, it doesn't even matter. I don't like to say this because I'm sympathetic up to a point to the people who think that, thank you for your service. Yes, and I've got 27 yellow ribbon bumper stickers on the back of my car. Unfortunately, war, unless you're an arsehole, requires a bit more than that. And it's absolute. I wrote about this at the time. At the time of the evacuation from, well, it wasn't really an evacuation. You don't evacuate the way they'd just redone Bagram Air Base and made it state of the art. And then they just abandon it. They don't tell their so-called allies. So the British and the Europeans wake up one morning and find that the Americans left in the middle of the night without telling anyone. You can't do it. You've lost the knack of war. I think it's all the money, actually. I think if you say, oh, money, no object, shock and awe, baby, we can do this for 20 years. And at the end result is that the Taliban are now one of the most well-armed militaries on the planet. Because they're goat herds with fertilizer, they're not using a lot of the stuff. So if they ever do want to use it, it probably won't work. But they don't need to be, I see all the helicopters. I don't know how they work or anything, but I don't need a helicopter because I've got fertilizer and string. And that's all I need to see off the great Satan. America, I can't, I'm so, do you know, at the time of that scuttle out of Kabul, at that time, I remember driving from the New Hampshire border up whatever that Interstate 89 all the way to Burlington, Vermont. I think I was catching a plane or something. And they had on every bridge over the interstate, they had people with these memorials for a veteran of Afghanistan who'd committed suicide after hearing about the retreat from Kabul. Because like everybody else who'd done tours of duty over the last 20 years, you had some families where the father had been in Afghanistan and the son had been in Afghanistan. And for what? What are these people dying or getting their legs blown off for in a war in which almost from the moment the Mullah Omar, the one-eyed Mullah, scuttled out of town, and if you recall at that point, CENTCOM or whatever they're called, the guys in Florida running the war, odd, by the way, to be running a war in Afghanistan out of Florida. And those, they had Mullah Omar's car as he was fleeing in their sights. And one of the JAGs, you know, the lawyers, the military lawyers, as they asked for permission to drone Mullah Omar, which would have been a great thing on the first night of the war. And they got back, my JAG's not happy about this. So it was a war run by lawyers from the get-go. And like everything else run by American lawyers, are you surprised at the way it turned out? It took a lot of time and it cost a lot of money, just like anything else involving American lawyers. It took even longer than my case in the District of Columbia, but it cost almost as much. If you're in a case in the District of Columbia, the death count is rather less for the moment than a war in Afghanistan. But America is just crap at war and can't do it. What war has accomplished an American strategic objective now since VJ Day? People have got to get serious about it. It's not a left-right thing. You know, the left say, all we are saying is give neocon warmongering a chance. And the establishment right are just saying, oh, thank you for your service. And here's another yellow ribbon bumper sticker you can put on your car. It's awful. It's awful. I don't want to get any more heated about it. But this idea of hearing Mark Levin go back, oh, peace through strength. All right. Where's the bloody strength? After 20 years in Afghanistan, again, Victoria Nuland's husband, Kagan, keeps going, oh, America's got the finest, it's got the most expensive equipment. Nobody has smarter smart bombs. Yeah, that's right. And the goat herds with fertilizer don't have anything smart. They don't even have smart goats. But they kicked your ass. Chris Davis says, hi, Mark. I hope you are well. As you highlighted in the officer class, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, one of the best things that Pete Hegseth did was ordering those portraits. And this is gives you an idea of the micro level of reform that is possible. But it was a great moment when he said, no, thoroughly modern Milley, with all his medals from shoulder to scrotum, we're not having his portraits up. What does he do? He's a great object lesson in how to take 20 years to lose a war. And again, as I say, 40% of the planet's military spending. And there's a lot of people on the rah-rah right, the Mark Levins, who are happy to mock other countries. You know, we may be crap, but let's face it, the Belgian army's pretty crap. Yeah, well, they're crap on an annual budget of $1.57, you know. So they can be crap for $1.57, and you are crap for 40% of the planet's total military spending. It's a disgrace. It's a complete disgrace. And the right waited too long until Trump. If it weren't for Trump, the Mark Levin view of American power, peace through strength. We're going into Syria, and we're going to take 20 years to lose in Syria. Even a proxy war. You know, I feel sorry for the Ukrainians, because that's a meat grinder. That's a meat grinder. It's the closest thing in the modern era to the trenches of the Great War. They're fighting for towns that nobody outside Ukraine is in the least bit interested in. And they're getting killed and crippled in large numbers. But let's be clear, America's been running that war from day one. It's an American-run war. It's like running Afghanistan from CENTCOM in Florida. It's an American-run war, and it's yet another American defeat. There's got to be, at some point, you've got to get real about this. We're coming to the end. I talked about the Venetian Republic, 1,100 years. Just the money will defeat you alone. Because right now, between the Chinese debt and your own military budgets, you're basically paying for two armies. You know, so if there ever is a war with China, the American taxpayer will be funding both sides, as I said in After America. But China's teaching us, and Russia's until the Ukraine war was teaching us, that there are other ways to do these things. You know, there's not going to be a war with China. You can't go to war with a country that makes all your aspirins and suppositories. You can't go to war with so they cut off the supply chain after the first 10 days of the war, there's bugger all in Walmart. You think you can go to war with the country that makes everything in your house? Anyway, Chris Davis said, sorry, I'm getting carried away, and I shouldn't be, but it infuriates me, this, because I live in a loser part of America. And all around me are people who believe the bollocks and went off to these endless unwon wars. And then they come back and they have to be fitted out with artificial limbs, or they need a charity to build them a disabled friendly house or whatever. Awful. Chris Davis says, Mark, I hope you're well. As you highlighted in yesterday's journal, it comes to something when that scumbag Starmer, masquerading as the UK Prime Minister, channels Enoch Powell on the folly of open-door immigration. Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, draws a parallel with a certain niche Canadian in America alone in being right too soon. After the manifest failures of so-called conservatism at the ballot box in the UK, Canada and Australia, my belief is that true conservatism and a moratorium on all immigration may yet have a renaissance, given the movement of the Overton window in recent times. My question to you is twofold. Am I right? And even if I am, are we already too late, which is really all that matters at this stage? Well, Enoch... And to be honest, I think I myself were in America alone. If anything, understated it. This is the end stage. Unless absent clear, decisive change of course, this is the end phase of Western civilization. So we're not going to make it 1,100 years like the Venetian Republic. And in fact, the only thing that anyone will ever say about the American Republic is that the end of Western civilization came on America's watch. Because it is actually quite impressive, as I say, to account for 40% of the planet's military spending and have your entire civilization sliding off a cliff. And we are in the last cycle in which it will be possible to reverse it electorally. So if the do-nothing Republican Congress manages to bollocks up Trump 47 as they did Trump 45 and sabotage Trump 45, then that will be extreme. This, I do believe this is America's last chance. And I'm not interested in, you know, these think tank debates, you know, having arguing about philosophical abstractions as to what is the best way. They're, those kinds of debates are luxuries. In the early 90s, say, you would be able to have philosophical discussions on this or that. But right now, what's happening is that Joe Biden admitted millions and millions of people who just walked into the country and left to their own devices will change the country if they're not gotten rid of. And that is the same thing in the United Kingdom, in Canada, in Australia, in Europe, Western Europe, that those people are going to have to, some of those people are going to have to be gotten rid of, and not just the illegals, and not just the non-citizens. And it is interesting to me how the Overton window has moved to the point where remigration has become a word. All these people have countries of their own to go back to. It's not like they're going to be homeless. They have countries in which they lived. And if you look at Britain or France or Germany, and those are the three biggest second-tier powers in the Western Alliance. Okay, there's the United States, then we have Britain, France, and Germany. And those are all fairly ancient nations. Well, Germany isn't really, but the German people have certainly been in their, whatever it was, dozen major principalities, have been major players in Europe. And the idea of them just all exiting the stage of history is a sobering thought. Permanence is the illusion of every age. That's another Stein line. It's not too late. The solutions are going to be tough. As I said, I always talk about the French example, where they used to talk, the guy 20 years ago who published that cracking book on the lost territories of the Republic. That's places that are now considered to be the banlieue, they were then, the Dar al-Islam. It was considered to be, they were considered by their local Muslim leaders as Muslim territory. And if a French interior minister or a French police chief wanted to come enter that territory, he was supposed to ask permission of these guys. That was 20 years ago. You were talking about big urban centres. And then, as I noted a couple of years back, it declined. So that places in the middle of nowhere, town of 3,000 people is trending the same way as the big banlieue. And I thought to myself, so I was talking with someone about it, said, oh, no, now it's down to 2,000 people. That makes it tougher. That makes it tougher. And it makes it tougher, too, when it's like that French church near Avignon, when the newspaper reported it as gangs of quote-unquote youths who bust into the church during Mass and were shouting Allahu Akbar and how they were going to bleep Jesus. And I take it from the way that the newspaper put it that if it identified these Muslims as youths, the French guys were older. And that's part of the problem, because the demographic energy means that in Germany, in France, in England, not so much in Scotland or Northern Ireland, but the young people are increasingly the strangers, or that's not a good way of putting it. The island of strangers thing, I think, is that you will be the foreigner in your own land. That's what it's all about. And that's true in Canada. Canada, replacement demography, just to keep a stable population, you're supposed to have a fertility rate of 2.1 kids. A couple has 2.1 kids. The 0.1 is there because people get sick and die. But if two people have 2.1 kids on average, you can't do it just as a couple on your own, then that will maintain a stable population. No growth. So you got 10 million people today, you'll have 10 million people in 20 years' time. No growth. Once you get to one, I said this again 20 years ago, 1.3 children per couple. That's what demographers call lowest low fertility, from which no society on earth has ever recovered. You know what Canada's is right now? 1.33. So they're on the cusp of lowest low fertility. And when you consider all the people that Justin Trudeau let into your country this last decade, you've got to bet that the people having all the kids are the people Justin let in, and that Canadians are the actual birth rate of legacy Canadians or Poulin Quebecers, Quebecois de souche, whatever you want to call them, must be getting down to statistically undetectable levels. There won't be enough unless, this is why I keep talking about forming MILF, my paramilitary organization, because there won't be enough people to be able to reverse it. There are still just about now, but it involves talking about remigration. We had a bit of breaking news just before I started that at HMP Woodhill, this is the maximum so-called toughest prison in England, somebody has just managed to, yet again, to slash the throat of a prison officer at HMP Woodhill. Now, we had the thing the other day where Rutu, the whatever he's called, Rutu Cabana, the guy who killed those little girls in Southport, managed to throw boiling water over a prison guard. Then we had the guy from the Ariana Grande massacre. He managed to throw burning cooking oil over three people and sent them to hospital. I believe two are still there. So what do we learn from that? We learn that among the most wanted people on earth have access to things, have access to blades, have access to boiling water, have access to boiling cooking oil, that Tommy Robinson doesn't, because Tommy Robinson is banged up in solitary confinement while they drive him insane. That's the object, to break his brain so that he comes out a dead husk. And instead, if you kill dozens of people at the Ariana Grande concert, you're rewarded by being given access to boiling cooking oil. If you slaughter the three little girls at Southport, you're rewarded by being given boiling water. If you, whoever this guy was, he's rewarded by being given access to improvised bladed articles. This can't go on. And you can't have normal politics in this world. The prisons in the United Kingdom are run by Muslim gangs. This was admitted at Tommy Robinson's hearing. It's so bizarre to hear both the plaintiff and the defense agree that the prisons are just run by Muslim gangs. Wait a minute. You're supposed to be His Majesty's government. It's called His Majesty's prison. His Majesty spends all his time sucking up to Islam. And so naturally they take it, oh yeah, we can run the prisons. The king won't mind. When they say it's His Majesty's prison, he's just outsourced it to Islam. Great. J.T. Bourne says, Dear Mark, I would like your eminent legal commentary on this new phrase that I heard this week, very Brexity things. This is in reference to the Kent police who bust into this guy's house to take him down over a tweet. And in the course of their absolutely absurd and actually, as I read English law, illegal search, because you're only meant to search proportionately. These disgusting Kent police goons went through everything from the basement to the attic. But they started with the wanker copper looking at the bookshelf and looking at the copy of The Spectator on the dining room table or wherever it was and saying, oh, these are very Brexity things. Yeah, yeah. So you're at war because the majority of the country voted for Brexit. So apparently in Kent, the Kent Constabulary regarded as suspicious if you take the same view, if you have the same views on Brexit as the majority of your countrymen. I can't stand the... I happened to meet a retired police officer a few days ago, and I said there are few institutions. He was a perfectly pleasant fellow. He'd left some years ago, but I said there are few institutions I loathe more than these the current British police, who have betrayed every aspect of their inheritance. The British invented the Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, the first modern police force, invented by Sir Robert Peel, whose great line was, the police are the public and the public are the police. Not in Kent, are they? Where the Kent police say if you express the same views on Brexit as the majority of the United Kingdom population, oh, they're very Brexity things. Maybe we, six people to take this guy down wasn't enough. Maybe we should have brought 24. J.T. Bourne continues, does the sentence differ for first degree versus second degree Brexitiness? Does misdemeanour Brexitiness get you only a fine and probation? If you are charged with Brexitiness, can you assert the affirmative defence of sympathy for the Windsor framework? I appreciate your insights as we wait for the UK Supreme Court to weigh in. I'm in favour that the crime clear-up rate in England and Wales, as Palm Sandu and I used to talk about, is barely detectable statistically now. In London, it's something like 1.4%. They don't, as Palm told me, they won't go to your house to investigate a burglary, but they will go to your house to arrest you over a tweet because they can get a result on that. So the British state has incentivized thought crime. I'm very worried that my friend Lawrence Fox, who has a court date coming up this week, will wind up in the same jail conditions as Tommy Robinson, because I think they'd like to break him too. They take the famous ones and they make an example of them. And yes, occasionally you'll get like an obscure, unknown one who'll hang himself in his cell. And that's good too, because if you hang yourself, then that tells other people, oh, this guy, he was upset because three little girls were killed in Southport. Two-tier Keir sent him to jail and now he's dead. And that works for Keir. As I said, the biggest thing is, that's why this whole sort of DC think tank approach to what's real philosophical conservatism. They're trying to kill you. They tried to kill Trump. Two guys, one guy actually put a bullet in the guy's head, just very briefly, and just a surface touch. But that's how close they got to blowing the guy's head apart on live television. And that would have worked for them too. Ah, you see? You step out there, you think you want more than Tom Tillis or what's the speaker called, Benny Johnson? Oh, okay, you can vote for the guy, but someone's just going to blow his head off on live TV. And there's been, Secret Service, who looked the other way and enabled, that's the best way to put it, and enabled that to happen. You know, they don't care whether you die. They really don't. Because it's about power with them. And so, what was I reading? A piece by Mark Judge somewhere or other. He was reading this biography of Bill Buckley. And so he started talking about today's National Review, which is an entirely irrelevant publication. I remember, you know, many people at National Review mocking that guy, Michael Anton, who framed 2016 as the Flight 93 election. Well, it is. Well, or to put it this way, it's like German airline, the subsidiary of Lufthansa, where the guy locked himself in the cockpit and flew the plane into the mountain. That's basically what's happening to the Western world. These guys, however you want to call them, the Uniparty, the Permanent State, the Deep State, whatever, they've locked themselves in the cockpit and they want to keep flying the plane into the mountain. And we're getting closer and closer to the mountain. That guy wasn't wrong on that. This is Stein Online's live Clubland Q&A. It's our 8th birthday. I thank you for all the nice things you've said on the 8th birthday. Not of Stein Online. We've been here for 22 years now, but the Mark Stein Club is 8 years old, and I'm absolutely staggered by the number of people who joined on day one, day two, week one, our first fortnight, who have decided to sign up for a ninth year with us. It's really quite amazing that, and I'm very grateful to you all. But here is what many people regard as the favourite part of the show. I'm doing the passive-aggressive thing again. Because here is Mark Stein to tell you all about what's coming up on our weekend music show. Go, Mark! Hey, this is Mark Stein. Are you excited about the Eurovision Song Contest? Nah, me neither. But would you like to hear Frank Sinatra sing a Eurovision Song Contest song? What is it? Boom, bang, a bang, ding, ding, a dong, diggy loo, diggy lay. We'll play it along with some other big Euro hits. On the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio. 5 p.m. London time is 6 p.m. Western Europe or 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 13 to 4 Eastern Time. That's 13 to 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. I'm trying to find the... I just saw just now a question about some of the music we had in one of our promos. I'm trying to find where that's gotten to. Perhaps... one of the vast team could figure out where it is. It's the question about the Crows promo music. Anyone know where that's gotten to? Well, I'll answer it anyway. Somebody said they wanted to know about... They're missing our Crows promo because that was the promo for the last Crows. which has happened. It happened last month. The next cruise will be next year. We'll be on the Queen Mary 2, sailing from Quebec City to New York City, but via the beautiful Saguenay Fjord, where the whales are all dancing and diving around you. But somebody, I'm terribly sorry I don't have your name, because the email does not seem to be visible to me. But this person says he's missing the cruise promo because it had an absolutely perfect fermata at the end. And who doesn't like a perfect fermata? I could tell you what it is, but I'm trying to enrage you, so you throw boiling cooking oil over me. Now, I do know what it is. That's right at the end of the music. The music, I'm sort of slightly surprised to get the question, because it's April in Portugal, which was a big hit, but it was a big hit in the 1950s, which was another country. And we picked it because our cruise was in April, and it was calling up Portugal. It's a marvellous piece of music. That was a perfect fermata, although that's the arrangement, not the composition. Raul Ferrau, if I recall correctly, was the guy who wrote the music, and he's from Portugal, but it was Jimmy Kennedy from Port Stewart in Northern Ireland who put a lyric to it. And you know that Jimmy Kennedy was a very nice guy, and I knew him a little just in the last couple of years before he died, and we had many lovely conversations about his fantastic catalogue, which includes April in Portugal is very typical because he wrote South of the Border, Down Mexico Way, Isle of Capri, Istanbul, not Constantinople. He didn't. He wrote occasional things about the Emerald Isle, but he preferred to survey the distant horizon. We had another, just while I'm at it here, we had another question about music. This was relating... this was rather an interesting question. This is from the Not-So-Gay Hussar. I think we've got a gay hussar joke in The Prisoner of Windsor, if you like your gay hussar jokes. But the Not-So-Gay Hussar says he wouldn't be joining those Saudi princes in getting down to YMCA. The Not-So-Gay Hussar says, "Hi, Mark, not interested in waving that constitution at you, but rather waving the LP jacket of Sinatra's Cycles. It was your brilliant Sinatra Centenary series that first brought me to your corner of the internet, and why, oh, why isn't that a book? And only recently did I do the decent thing and become a member. Anyway, well, we're glad to have you with us. You waited 8 years just to see if we were here for keeps, and we are. I'm glad. Anyway, the LP jacket of Cycles lists Wait by the Fire on the track list, but on the back it says it was substituted for My Way of Life. That's a Bert Camfort tune that we had Caterina Valenti singing on the show a few months back. After much research, one has to amuse oneself somehow to stop ruminating on the pending civilizational collapse. The jury is out on whether Wait by the Fire was recorded or not. The co-composer Chip Taylor, the Wild Thing guy, Wild Thing, I think I love you, seems to be... Oh, God, I feel the eighth heart attack coming on now. Seems to think it was. Others suggest it was recorded, but never mastered or simply rehearsed and binned. Hard to believe it could be actually worse than My Way of... You are my way of life, however it goes. Can't remember it now. The other Taylor track on Cycles, Pretty Colours, despite a dreadful arrangement and a choral group that sounds like a ululating BBC Home Service choir trapped in a yellow submarine, suits Mr. Sinatra nicely. As a guy who has talked to a lot of music guys, I was wondering if you ever ran across Chip Taylor, who seems an affable old cove, and got any insight. You're my last hope. P.S. Because of you, I find myself dropping the phrases soi-disant and en passant in cocktail conversation, hence finding myself invited to fewer cocktail parties. I'm sorry about that. C'est vraiment tragique. I don't think I've ever met Chip Taylor. Is it Chip Taylor or the other one? Yeah, the Wild Thing guy. I don't think I've ever met Chip Taylor, but I have met, is he the one, one of those two guys is the brother of John Voight. And I have met John Voight because I discussed the Iranian nuclear program with him. And John Voight is certainly a big Sinatra fan. So I feel I sort of have got close to Chip Taylor via his brother. When it comes to that song, whatever it's called, Wait by the Fire, I did remember because I'd seen this album sleeve decades ago, and not long before Don Costa died, I asked him about this, and he said he'd done an arrangement. He did the arrangements for that album, and he'd said he'd done an arrangement of that song. And then for whatever reason, Frank was pretty, because it was like sort of contemporary songs they thought Frank might be able to get a handle on, which isn't always the easiest thing to do. And he, that had somehow wound up on the list, I think, from somebody at Reprise, probably Sonny Burke, who was his producer then. And Frank... I think it was Bill Miller or Jimmy Van Heusen came round to the house and played it on the piano for him. And he was sort of not motivated by it and so set it aside. So there is no, it's not like the version of Chicks and Ducks and Geese, sorry, with the fringe on top that I played the other day, where people didn't know there was a vocal and then they're just rootling around and they come across a vocal. There was no vocal recorded about that. Patrick Gagan says, hello, Mark, hope you're well today. The other day I read a stat that Republicans have sent the fewest bills to a president in 70 years. Oh, you do surprise me. You do surprise me. The do-nothing Republican Congress. This is the thing. They're waiting Trump out until they lose the midterm elections and then there's nothing. So now they're just sort of stalling legislation. Is this 2016 all over again when the Republican-controlled houses of Congress sat on their hands and did nothing to advance Trump's agenda? I think I actually said that a couple of weeks ago after that guy, what's he called, the speaker, is he Benny or whatever he's called? I don't know. He doesn't really seem, it doesn't seem the most demanding job. He can probably do it from home or probably do it from a beach in the Bahamas. Doesn't seem to involve actually advancing the president's legislative agenda. We have government by executive action, which is why the Democrats were forced to go to district court judges to strike down the executive actions as illegal. Whereas in the good old days, what they'd be doing in the present setup in Congress would be going to John McCain or Lisa Murkowski or whoever and turning votes against the president so he couldn't pass anything. My gosh, says Patrick, what a useless party. And yes, they are. This is the mainstream Republican Party. They're in the locked cockpit with the Democrats and they don't want the plane that's heading for the mountain to turn away from the mountain. So they're not legislating. They're not doing anything. And I think this was clear. Trump knows this. None of these people are friends. If you look at who's in his cabinet, they're people who, like him, are pariahs in their own party, like Tulsi Gabbard and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., for example, because they're in the same position that Trump's in. Their own party, so-called, reviles them. And so I think he understood. And he saw, he's not doing anything new in a sense, because he saw what happened with Joe Biden, because Joe Biden took office at midday on January the 20th. And by 12/27, he had undone the entire previous 4 years just by revoking all Trump's executive actions. And I think that Trump expects the same thing to happen next time round, or assuming he can bequeath the presidency to J.D. Vance, you know, the time after that. That's just the way it is. He's not a Republican. He's not a Republican because the wars are only, you know, what have the conservative parties of America and Canada and Britain and Australia actually conserved? The country's got less and less. So we're having discussions about whether women can have penises. They conserve nothing. And then they had, on top of it, they sent all these people to die in wars they were never serious about. And I think Trump understands, Trump knows Washington now. And so he can, if you notice, he can have all these people over those things you used to say. Remember when Pelosi and Schumer took over Congress and Bush had them over and they're sitting around the table and Bush is talking about good faith proposals to work on things they can all agree on. They don't actually agree on anything, you know, because one side wants to turn your little girl into a little boy and the other side, or part of the other side, thinks that's sick and abusive and actually makes us morally on the same plane as Islam, because it's, you know, you can't complain about a Sudanese clitoridectomist if you're also mutilating some little middle school girl. You've lost any kind of moral advantage you once might have had. So Trump is not a, I don't think Trump is a, you, Trump isn't a Republican. If you notice, the one sort of establishment Republican he had in his cabinet was that guy Waltz, who's gone, because again he proved an untrustworthy little SH1T. So I don't think there's a surprise about this, and I think it's sad. But I think the thing is if you can win two terms or occasionally three terms, like Reagan, Bush, then you understand that after 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, the pendulum's going to swing and some guy's going to undo everything. But until you have parties, I mean, a lot of these issues are 80-20 issues. The American, even a majority of Democrats don't want open borders. But unfortunately, one and one half of the only two parties do want them. And that's a problem. Queen of the Jungle says, "Dear Mark, I must confess that I did not have on my bingo card a veritable Trump rally in Saudi that ended with the former gay anthem of YMCA as its closing number. President Trump is the only world leader who has the imagination and the balls to pull off a stunt like this. And his presidency is a once-in-a-lifetime event, as he proves every day. Speaking of which, I wonder how you would rate the first 100 days of the Trump regime when it comes to your own issues that you have covered for the past couple of decades, such as one, not so great Britain and Trump's dealings with Starmer et al., Trump on the Green New Deal scam and phony man-made global warming. 3. Immigration and the Great Replacement. 4. The CVD debacle and Warp Speed, the COVID debacle, I think that is, and Operation Warp Speed, plus the apology tour that never happened. 5. Not having anything to do with Trump, but would you care to weigh in on the Macron, Starmer, Mertz possible Coke scandal that did not involve Hunter Biden at all? Thanks for all that you do for what's left of Western Civ." Well, all I know from when I was in France is that anyone who knows Macron thinks he does cocaine and he needs to do it to cope with the strain of having to pretend to be a heterosexual in public. Anyway, take that for what I'm not connected. I did have, I've talked about this before. I did have the have a little interaction with one of Macron's many prime ministers. This one was called, what's it called? It ends with an X. Oh, Castex. I was having a little joke about that because the waitress at that restaurant where I took Monsieur Castex's parking space for when he descended by helicopter, but she remembered that and you know, a couple of years later brought it up to me. And I said, I couldn't remember the guy's name and she couldn't remember the guy's name. And then we both got it around about the same time. Castex was the prime minister. I said, prime minister in France, odd position, isn't it? Because you're incredibly important for about 6 weeks and then no one knows who the hell you are. And on the other stuff, which is more serious, the most important is immigration. Because that's costing you your country. I mean, the staggering, and again, it seems more obvious in Europe because Europe's turning Muslim. And but in America, if you look at the collapse of the so-called, I mean, they call it the white population now, but in fact, it's the legacy American population. It's the population that was considered as normal Americans. Until circa 1970, at which point it started, once the Teddy Kennedy bill kept in, it started sliding lower and lower. So now America is barely majority white. There's no precedent for this at all. I mean, people, oh, it's a perfectly natural phenomenon. The California ceasing to be majority white, that just happened naturally. No. It happened because of government policy. You chose to do that. And nobody, there's no precedent in it. You can laugh when I go on about the Venetian Republic, but they're not bloody stark staring nuts like the guys who've been running your country, where they think it's, they think le grand remplacement, the great replacement that poor old Tucker got into all this trouble for when he started talking about it, when just for a change he was on my show, a couple of years ago, and suddenly all the organizations start calling for him to be fired, which Mr. Murdoch eventually did. But he's not wrong. It's not normal. It's not normal for one within three generations, which is what it's going to be. So it's basically going to be from 1970 to 2030, in which ancient races, and I use race, I'm old-fashioned, so I use race not in terms of white or black or brown or Hispanic, but I just use race. They used to talk about the English race, which was something distinct from the Scottish race. The Swedish race was distinct from the Danish race. So Sweden was full of Swedes and Denmark was full of Danes, and it would be weird if Denmark suddenly became full of Swedes. I rather miss that world. And those races were entitled to have a country. It's not a question of whether, you know, oh, we're all going to get along and there'll be much better restaurants. Because let's face it, all those boring French restaurants in France, and now they're going to be having a lot more falafel. This is, aside from being moronic, this is a way to sell you, if you're an idiot, on something that is completely unprecedented, where all the countries that built the modern world have volunteered to go extinct. They're not going to be, you know, you can see, I've talked about this in, I think I mentioned it last week. If you go to Birmingham, England's second city, and it's a filthy dump. They got giant rats going through the street. There's trash everywhere. If you look at seriously Muslim cities in England, like Bradford, there's garbage everywhere. I know that. I think I said this last week when I was in Iraq. You're going through the Western Desert. You pass the occasional Bedouin encampment. It's basically a giant garbage heap with some tents pitched downwind. You go to villages. Yeah, I would say Rutbar's a village. It's a large village, but it's, I don't think anyone would consider it to be a giant metropolis. and there's trash everywhere. There's no municipal the condition. You know when you used to you drive around and you come to this these places. Say, oh, voted best. Most floral village of 2017 or whatever. There's none of that. You don't see any of that when you're tootling around rural Jordan or rural Iraq. So immigration and the Great Replacement is the thing. What and that's why having remigration as a word introduced, I think, and it's going to be expensive if that comes off. I mean, the Trump administration has offered people $1,000 to self-deport. Honestly, for that to prove effective, it's going to have to be more than that. But getting rid of the illegals shouldn't be a problem. It's incredibly difficult to do anything in America, even if you're legal. It's the Republic of Paperwork. I couldn't get over that. I couldn't get over the numbers on government forms, even the 1099. It always amused me. It came up in the Conrad Black trial when the finance director flew in from Toronto. The tax return in Canada is called T1 because it's the most basic item. And in America, the federal government, it's, what is it? What's it called? It's the 10, what is it? The 1040, I think. So they've already got a 1,039 other forms before you get to, I couldn't stand any of that. But you need to do that. Oh, I paid a guy $300. Oh, well, you're going to have a 1099 and a W-8 and we've got to be swapping paperwork and all of it. It's all... So why are the only group who are not discombobulated by that, the elite? It shouldn't be difficult in a country with that much paperwork to make it impossible for anyone to function. They are able to function because one and a half of the two political parties want them to be able to function. It's disgusting. So I don't think it should be that difficult to get rid of the illegals. And suddenly, I would say this. Again, you know, I had to sign all this paperwork and actually provide proof that I would not be a public charge on the people of the United States when I emigrated. And the reason for that is perfectly obvious. You know, I haven't paid into the system, so why should I be taking benefits out of it? And because I'm, you know, I was a so-called freelance writer, so the thought of government bureaucrats is that, okay, well, he did a piece for the Daily Telegraph and the National Post of Canada. But, you know, he's not an employee of any of these organizations. So who knows what he'll be earning next week? It all seems to vary a bit. And it was quite, you know, in that sense, they were quite serious about that. And then you notice, after wasting your time with these buggers for months and months on end, that there are tens of millions of people who just arrive, and on day one, they're leeching off me. And the taxpayers put up. Now, it shouldn't be hard at all to cut off that spigot. Because the free stuff is a lot of the... You know, the thing is, you can mock Waziristan or Somalia or wherever you want, but they say what you like. They're not being lavishly endowed the way all the people living high off the hog are in the US and Canada and the UK and Europe on public welfare. The minute you have, there should be no, if you come to the country, there should be a minimum amount of time before you can receive a dime. That thing about having to prove you're not going to be a public charge should be taken seriously. But the solutions, it's interesting that remigration has become a word now, because it illustrates why it would have been easier to start doing this stuff back when I wrote America Alone 20 years ago. Because the words are going to be getting crueler and harder. Enough people don't want it. You know, there are going to be millions and millions of your friends and neighbors who go along with it, who say, oh, yeah, I'd like to sleepwalk into endless night. Because if we go down this path, if America becomes a giant Latin American favela of MS-13 and drug mules and sex predators, and the rest of the West becomes just, you know, another Islamic crappy stan, it's going to be 300 to 500 years to get out of that. It's not going to be pleasant. And it's interesting to me that, so it's great, it's terrific to have a word like remigration. So suddenly you can say remigration in newspapers and on television and things, and people think, oh, yeah. You know, so Starmer doing what he did moved the Overton window. Trump actually deporting people and the Democrats doubling down on their Maryland men, right? That's great, that. Because it's an 80-20 issue, this. It really is. People don't want, and we're now at the point where you can see what it does. England, large parts of England look horrible. To anybody who knew them 30 years ago, they look horrible, including the capital city. And the same with Paris, the same with Berlin, the same with Rome. So things have changed, and you've got, and the other point I want to make is the people who make the difference here are going to make the difference. It's not going to be some messiah coming out down from the clouds to save you. It's going to be a critical mass of ordinary people. So if you're at a school board meeting, or if you're at the Ladies Aid Society or whatever, and people seriously want to say, oh, diversity is our strength, just laugh at them and say, no, it isn't. Where's the evidence for that? There's no evidence for that. Just don't let the people use diversity as our strength. The bloody king uses it. He may even say it when he opens the Canadian Parliament in a week's time. He may even say diversity is our strength from the bloody sodding Canadian throne. But it isn't true. And they get away with it by passing it off as just sort of this boilerplate that everybody has to say. It isn't. If you're a Canadian senator and you're going to be sitting there when their majesties are in the Canadian Senate and the King is delivering the government's throne speech, and he says diversity is our strength, boo him. Because the point about this stuff is it's not uncontested. It's like, and we saw how far they get. So like your little girl changing her pronouns and the school going along with it. So that is uncontentious now. We've all agreed somehow. We all agreed mysteriously that a woman with a penis in the shower with you is nothing unusual, that it's uncontroversial. There's an expert consensus on it. There is no societal consensus on this bollocks, on these literal bollocks, on these literal female bollocks. There's no societal consensus on that. So don't let them treat you as if there is. So if everyone stands up, that's complete bollocks. This guy, he's a perfectly pleasant fellow, but he likes wandering around in a dress and then coming into my changing room and taking it off. I quite like him personally. He's obviously got a few issues, but I'm not going to pretend that women with penises are just a thing that society has come to accept, because it's not true. So don't when they're peddling the big lie, the great, you know, the great insight of the Soviet Union was to understand that you didn't need people actually to believe the lie. You just had to force it down their throat and make, they didn't care whether you believed it. What they cared about was that you deferred to the lie. And now Eastern Europe is rather sane on that kind of issue, while we're completely bonk. Oh, yes, the gender assigned at birth. Gender assigned at birth. Well, the CBC and the BBC and CNN use that phrase, so there must be a perfectly respectable societal consensus on it. No, there isn't. Just shove the assigned penis at birth down their bloody throats every time they bring it up. Because there is no societal consensus. And if you don't resist it when they start doing that stuff, then in the end it will be the societal consensus. And we'll all be done. Okay, I've gotten too excited again. This is why my doctors don't like me doing this, don't approve. Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A, that's going to do it for today. Sorry I didn't get to many questions, got a bit worked up, sorry about that. I am sorry about it, actually. I remember the days when I just used to play Peggy Lee late night on the radio, and I didn't get so worked up then. Stick with Steyn Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura's going to round up the internet, as only she can. Our Mark Steyn Club 8th birthday observances continue with our 70th Tale for Our Time. Three Men on the Bummel by Jerome K. Jerome. The latest episode airs in a few hours' time. And do check out our first Mark Steyn show on video since my third heart attack in Trieste. Sammy Woodhouse, Samantha Smith, Alison Pearson. Three of my favourite ladies. It's a powerful show, and we hope if you haven't yet seen it, you'll want to check it out. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Steyn Club, well, we've made it 8 years, and we're looking forward to more years. So come on in. The water's fine. Stay safe. Stay free.
Mark Steyn's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Steyn Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.